We will start with agenda paper 2. The committee received a request about the accounting for a transaction in which an entity sells its equity interest in a subsidiary that holds only a real estate asset, losing control of that subsidiary, and leases the real estate asset back. Paragraphs 5 and 6 outline the fact pattern. The submitter asks whether the entity applies the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 and thus how the entity determines the gain on the transaction. We did not perform outreach on this matter for the reasons set out in paragraph 17. Paragraphs 18 to 37 present our analysis of how the entity accounts for the transaction, and paragraph 38 summarizes our conclusion. In our view, the entity applies IFRS 10 to account for the loss of control of the subsidiary and applies the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 to measure the right of use asset and the gain recognized on the transaction. I will now direct you to question 1 on page 14 and ask whether you agree with our analysis of the application of the requirements in IFRS standards.
Okay, before I open the floor, just to a reminder, it's a while since we had a meeting, and for the new members, the first thing we ask committee members to comment on is whether you agree with the analysis of the question based on IFRS requirements, and then we'll move on subsequently to what we might do about the question from an agenda decision or otherwise perspective. So firstly, question one, any comments on the analysis of the application of the requirements to the standard?
So I can maybe kick off.
Okay, Lisa?
So conceptually, I agree with the conclusion on how to determine the gain, but the part that I struggle with in the paper is around the interaction between IFRS 10, IFRS 15, which is referenced via IFRS 16, and how that is in agreement with the standards. So as the paper talks about in the June 2019 decision that we had, there we had agreed that IFRS 10, you apply that for the loss of control, but you would not look to IFRS 15 because IFRS 10 is out of scope of IFRS 15. But in the current paper, in going through the analysis, the paper refers to, obviously, you start with IFRS 10 and looking at the loss of control, but when you go to IFRS 16 and apply the guidance starting from paragraph 99, it then sends you into IFRS 15 to look at the derecognition criteria, and then you continue back in 16 to determine that calculation of the gain or loss. So when I looked in at IFRS 15, paragraph 5 states that IFRS 16 and IFRS 10 are out of scope of IFRS 15. And so to me, it's a bit of this conundrum where you can get yourself caught up in a bit of a circle going, well, I'm going into IFRS 16, but then if I go and I follow IFRS 16, into doing my derecognition analysis under 15. 15 tells me that I'm out of scope of IFRS 16, and I'm also out of scope in applying it if I'm in IFRS 10. Okay. So I think, to me, you know, maybe that what it is this paper just highlights that there's technically maybe a bit of an issue here in the referencing, and that potentially there is a need for a narrow scope amendment to address that.
I'd read it slightly differently when I picked up the requirements of IFRS 16, just to flag it in case others want to comment on it, which is that we could have reproduced the requirements of IFRS 15 to say this is how you do the test in IFRS 16, but instead of doing that, we just sort of used shorthand and said apply these ideas in IFRS 15 to make this assessment. Mm. So we're sort of copying the requirements as opposed to saying look at 15 and look at the scope of 15, which is the way that I had thought about it, but maybe others will have thoughts as well. So looking at the screen, Bob, would you like to speak?
Thanks, Sue. On this issue, I think it raises a number of root issues, but those are probably for the post-implementation review of 16 and 15, such as we have differences in how we describe control, which causes and puts pressure on when you have a subsidiary versus an asset. And then within 16, we have some issues I've spoken about before on the sale leaseback of while we lose control, but yet we say we partially retain control. But putting that aside, I think I agree with the staff, but I'm confused a little bit because of the different ways in the paper that we describe the model. In paragraph 37, I think, which is the part I agree with, I think we describe the model, Sue, which I think what you just described is you apply IFRS 10 in sequential steps. You first apply IFRS 10, say, did I lose control of the subsidiary? And if you pass that, then you apply IFRS 16, paragraphs 98 to 103, which would lead you in paragraph 99 to say, okay, applying the conditions for satisfying a performance obligation in 15, do I pass that? If I don't, I got to keep the building on my books. But if I do pass that, then I move on to it's a sale, paragraphs 100 to 102 in IFRS 16. But paragraphs 35 and 38 of the paper, I think shortchange that because it says in the staff recommendation, it says apply IFRS 10, apply B98, derecognize the building. It never goes through then the paragraph 99 of 16. So I just want to confirm if my understanding is correct. It is the sequential steps, right, that you apply 10, then you apply paragraph 99 of 16 to see if you then – get to derecognize the building. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, but Bob, sorry, this is Petrina here. I'll just come in and say, yes, you are right. I think we took some shorthand, for example, in paragraph 38, because we open with, in the transaction described in the submission, we sort of just jumped into then talking about the specific paragraphs in IFRS 10. And to your point, applying paragraph 100A, because part of the fact pattern, the transaction in a sense, it's already been concluded that the transfer of the building, you know, meets the sort of the requirements in IFRS 15 to be accounted for as a sale. But you're absolutely right to say the stepped process is that, as you describe.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Okay, so Young Sue, would you like to come in?
Oh, yes. Yes, please. I have a kind of confusion in the analysis. Everybody says about the sequential application of standards. I understand the same thing. The staff proposes that we have to apply IFRS 10 first and then IFRS 16 later. But I don't see any reasonings about why we have to follow that order. Why IFRS 10 first and then 16? Why not 16 first and then 10? The reason why I said I have some concern about it and also has a confusion is because of our prior agenda decision that the staff explained that paragraph 37B. If you look at paragraph 37B of the agenda, the staff paper, the staff explains some agenda decision that we made in 2018. So if you look at 2018 agenda decision, what we did was to apply the standard in a reverse order. I mean, at that time, we applied IAS 16 first, and then we applied IAS 28. The reason why I said the order is reversed is because of this. IAS 16 is about an asset, how an asset is transferred. And IAS 28 is about the transfer of an interest. So that at that time, we think first whether an asset has been transferred, and then we thought whether an interest has been transferred. But in the current agenda decision, we reversed the order. By considering IFRS 10, we considered whether the interest has been transferred, and then we considered IFRS 16, by considering IFRS 16, we thought whether there's a transfer of an asset. So I wonder when we apply the standard on the transfer of interest first, and then the standard on the transfer of asset, and when we apply the transfer of an asset first, and then the standard on the transfer of interest. So that, you know, in the agenda decision or in the staff paper, I think we have to explain something about it. When we apply what standard first and what the other standard later, and on what basis? Because there's no explanations about it. I was a little bit confused when I read the staff paper and the agenda decision.
Thank you. Petrina, did you want to respond?
Yes, and so maybe I'll just explain. So I'll split it into two parts, because I think you said you're just wondering why in our paper we decide you apply IFRS 10 first and then IFRS 16. And I suppose for us, certainly in this transaction, it wouldn't make sense to do the reverse, because almost you don't have a lease. If you came along first of all and just decided to apply IFRS 16 first, it sort of doesn't make sense, because you can't have a lease unless you've decided you've actually lost control of subsidiary and transferred the building. So the natural flow in this, I think, is to say, I've lost control of the subsidiary and therefore the asset, I've transferred the building, and because I've transferred the building, I now have a lease that then I come along and apply IFRS 16 to after I've concluded that I have actually lost control of the subsidiary and the building. To do it in the reverse kind of goes back to front, because, as I say, you can't say you have a lease until you've actually decided you've transferred control of that building to the third party. So that's why it's 10 and then 16.
You're leasing something you owned.
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise, exactly. So you'd be leasing something you owned. In my view, the other transaction you referred to that's mentioned in paragraph 37B of the paper, when the committee discussed that, to me, that had worked in exactly the same way. So in that case, it was talking about where you've contributed an item of PP&E to an associate. So before you look at the associate side of things, you first of all say, have I actually transferred, contributed that PP&E to the associate? So I first of all look at IS 16 to work out whether I've kind of de-recognised that item of PP&E. That's what I do first. That's equivalent in our transaction to looking at IFRS 10 and whether I've transferred control. And then as an overlay or second step, I look at IS 28 in the context of the measurement of any gain arising from that.
Okay.
I understand that. But, you know, the in the sale and leaseback transaction, I think the transfer of an asset and transfer of the lease or the transfer of the interest are designed together. I mean, before they, you know, really the asset or transfer the asset or make a lease back, you know, both the seller and buyer get together and make the whole design. And when they are agreed on the sales and lease back, they signed on the contract. So in reality, I don't think there could be anything ahead or behind. So that is why I'm saying.
Is that not also true just of a standard sale and lease back, though? I mean, you agree to sell and lease back, but we account for it as a sale and then a lease back. I thought it was quite analogous for me, but we'll see what others say. Jens?
Thank you, Sue. I'm happy to go next. I fully agree with the conclusion of the staff paper, and I do think I understand that this is a two-step approach. First step is loss of control, and second step is apply the leaseback requirements. And I fully agree with the reference made in paragraph 26 to the discussion the committee had in June 2019, because I do think it's very relevant to pick up the discussion and the interaction between IFRS 10 and IFRS 15. And I'd like to add and echo what Lisa already mentioned, that it's a little bit confusing how the line of argumentation is. Because when I read 28, especially, and the discussion and the entries in 29, one might think that we prejudice the open question that has been addressed to the committee in June 2019. Well, because my recollection is that this question is now still open, whether IFRS 10 or IFRS 15 comes first. And I think for this matter, I would say for this question that is now addressed, it's only a question of whether there's a loss of control, and it's irrelevant whether the loss of control is a sales transaction or a disposal of a subsidiary, because we say, first of all, there comes the derecognition event, and then we apply the leaseback guidance, and I find it hard to understand the reasoning in 29, especially with the journal entries, when we post the credit gain on sale, because it also could be a revenue transaction. And I think it should be highlighted in the paper or made clearer that these question whether 10 or 15 apply to the disposal or sale transaction whatever, that this is scoped out from the analysis and that the analysis is only focusing on first question, is there a loss of control? And when there is a loss of control, then the leaseback guidance in 16 applies. I think that would make it clearer for the analysis.
And Brian, I might let you in now. We don't have our normal Toblerones, so there's no way of signalling if you're in the room. You're at a disadvantage.
I can wave my water bottle. So I agree with the conclusion in the staff paper. I think that IFRS 16, when it talks about sale and leaseback, has quite a sensible statement, which is essentially that you don't book a gain on rights that you have retained. As you don't book a gain on the rights that you've retained. The way that statement is articulated, it's articulated in a way that is agnostic to the legal form of the transfer leg. So it doesn't matter for the purposes of applying that statement whether the legal form of the transfer leg is a sale of an asset or a lease of an asset or a sale of shares in an entity that contains just that asset. And that's why I agree with the conclusion in the staff paper. In terms of reconciling the scope of the candidate standards, the way I think about this, I think that the transaction in this fact pattern is never in the scope of 15. I think all you do is you look at some very specific paragraphs in 15. You use a bit of technology in 15, but you never do that because you're in the scope of 15. You do that because you're cross-referred to that particular test in 15. So I think you're never in 15. I think you are in 10 in this specific fact pattern, because in this specific fact pattern, the legal form of the transaction is a transfer of shares. And that's why you're in 10. And I think you're in 16, because if you do have a transfer and you're leasing back, you have a sale and leaseback transaction, and therefore you don't book the gain on the right you've retained. So it's the kind of thing, I kind of wish I had a whiteboard, because I think I go at 15 purely to apply some 15 technology, not because I'm in the scope of 15. I apply IFRS 10 because I'm legally transferring shares, and I apply 16 because I am in fact leasing back something I've transferred. And in this particular fact pattern, in contrast to the one last year about sales of real estate entities, there doesn't seem to be a conflict between the two sets of requirements of the two standards I'm in scope of being 10 and 16.
Mary, do you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to use my cleaning wipes as my Toblerone. And just following up on that point about the previous agenda decision that the committee reached, and I guess, Jens, it's back to your comment, because you looked at paragraph 29 of the paper for today and said you think that credit gain on sale could alternatively be a credit to revenue. And I think that the agenda decision that the committee reached, I'm looking at Petrina, maybe a year or so ago, which then went to the board to ask the board if we should do standard setting to put some subset of sale of entity transactions into IFRS 15. Ultimately, the board decided not to. Means to me that there's no question about that credit gain on sale being potentially credit revenue. And I guess that complements, Brian, what you were saying about it's never in the scope of 15. You're just pointed to certain paragraphs of 15 to think about the question of, does this sale transaction have substance? Mm.
All right, now I'll go back to the screen. So, Carsten.
Thank you. So let me start by saying that I do agree with the conclusion that sale-leaseback guidance applies and thus that gain recognition should be restricted. I think quite simply, as highlighted in the paper, that because there is a transfer of an asset which is then leased back by the transferor and there's no scope out, in IFRS 16 for rights and obligations within the scope of IFRS 10. So I agree with the staff, and also as highlighted by Brian, that the legal form, how the asset is transferred, doesn't matter. I do have some comments about specific aspects of the analysis, which are a little bit similar to the ones from Yang Su. That is, I too wasn't fully convinced about the notion of an overlay approach. And I'll explain in a minute why. I find it a little bit difficult to say that IFRS standards require you to look at IFRS 10 first and then apply an overlay approach. So basically apply any other standard that is not scoped out. Now, I acknowledge that if you look at the scope sections of IFRS 16 and IFRS 10, then it seems hard to disagree that both standards are applicable. However, if that's the case, I think the issue that we need to address more clearly is that the two standards appear to have conflicting guidance with respect to gain recognition. So if we go ahead saying that both IFRS 16 and IFRS 10 apply, I think it would be helpful to be more clear in the wording of the agenda decision why the requirement in paragraph B98D of IFRS 10 does not apply. So I think an alternative way to look at this might be to conclude that at least with regards to gain recognition pattern, there's no guidance in IFRS that specifically addresses sale-leaseback transactions involving a corporate wrapper. And so one should look at the IS 8 hierarchy to determine which IFRS standards deal with similar or related issues. In addition, it could also be argued that IFRS 10 doesn't contemplate a situation that includes a leaseback of assets, whereas IFRS 16 does contain specific guidance for transfers of assets that are leased back. And for these reasons, at least with respect to gain recognition, I would view the IFRS 16 guidance as the relevant, more specific guidance that should be applied in this fact pattern. If we were to introduce a notion of an overlay approach, my main concern would be around potential unintended consequences on other fact patterns. In particular, I wouldn't want to suggest a notion that if a transaction is clearly in the scope of one IFRS standards, you would also need to consider all other IFRS standards that are not specifically scoped out. I think the submission raises some other related questions, such as, for example, how to deal with a situation where the subsidiary contains multiple assets and potential liabilities which may or may not meet the definition of a business. But I do acknowledge that this certainly goes beyond the question that has been submitted. I also agree with the comments that some of these aspects should be looked at as part of the IFRS 10 PIR. With regards to the proposed wording, I think we will come to that later, but in more detail. But I would note that the agenda decision specifically mentions paragraph B98 of IFRS 10, but is silent on the requirement in B98D that suggests full gain recognition. And I think this should be addressed in the final wording of the agenda decision. For example, by adding a sentence to the agenda decision that acknowledges that IFRS 10 does not contemplate a situation that involves a leaseback and that clarifies that IFRS 16 contains more specific and relevant guidance with regards to gain recognition in a sale-leaseback transaction, which we have here.
Okay, thanks, Carsten. Next is you're showing up as Mr. Vivendi in my system, Bertrand. Mr. Vivendi.
Thank you, Sue. Yeah, it's me, effectively. I agree with the staff analysis and the staff conclusion. I share most comments provided by Jens or Brian with regards to the agenda paper and the proposed tentative agenda decision. I heard some members say today that there is a form of tension maybe between IFRS 10, 15, 16. I don't see that. I think the notion of control is the same in all standards, whether you consider there the control of the right to use of the asset in IFRS 16 or the control entails within the notion of transfer of control in IFRS 15, or whether you consider controlling an entity and hence the assets and liabilities in the balance sheet of this entity controlled, and effectively when you lose control of an entity in IFRS 10, you transfer the control you got to the acquirer of the entity to whom you have sold the equity interest. So I think the notion, to revert back to the notion of state and leaseback, whereby in IFRS 16 you need first to analyze IFRS 15 to assess whether or not you have transferred control, to me it's totally equivalent of the transfer of control when you lose the control of an interest. And in this specific pattern, maybe, you get to a very similar conclusion where whether you transfer the control of the asset directly in accordance with IFRS 15, or whether you transfer the control of the equity interest applying the provisions of IFRS 10. And it's just because the only asset within the entity is the PN. So I see tricky tension there. Between those, this notion of control, and I think effectively the conclusion reached by the staff is the proper one for this fact pattern.
Okay, thank you, Bertrand. Guy.
I think generally agree with the outcome that is arrived at through the. The technical analysis in the paper. I did pause in thinking through all of this as to whether this two-step approach that is laid out in the paper could potentially have unintended consequences, you know, perhaps similar to what Karsten was highlighting. And the one particular aspect of IFRS that I was a bit stuck on when thinking about that was some of the past deliberations and amendments that were made to address this perceived conflict between IFRS 10 and IAS 20 on transfer of an entity to an associate or a joint venture. I think I've resolved that potential concern in that fact pattern. You know, I think that debate was more about whether a business entity or a non-business entity constituted a non-monetary asset, and therefore, you know, does the IFRS 10 guidance apply, or does the IAS 28 guidance apply? And so, certain amendments were made and then deferred to try and navigate that issue. But it struck me that that's a bit of a different issue than what we're dealing with here, in that. We have a fairly clear statement in BC 261 of IFRS 16 that says, you know, form doesn't matter. So in that sense, this sort of two-step model, I think, works in the context of IFRS 10 and IFRS 16 and is different than the other circumstances that I was concerned about, and whether this two-step model might override some of the past thinking on the interaction of IAS 10, IFRS 10 and IAS 28. So I think I've resolved that particular challenge, potential consequence with this in the analysis on this issue. However, one remaining area that I'm still pausing on in my mind and not clear if there is the potential for conflict, is whether there could be a situation where I lose control of the entity under IFRS 10, but I have not transferred building in this fact pattern under the criteria in IFRS 15. And, you know, I haven't sort of formulated a specific fact pattern where that might be the case, but I wonder about a purchase option, for example, and whether I could have an outcome where my conclusion is, well, I need to deconsolidate the entity under IFRS 10, but I do not have a transfer control criteria. That doesn't seem to be the fact pattern at hand in the submission, but we clearly reference paragraph 1.3 in the discussion and don't, you know, further explore whether there could be a potential conflict between 10 and 16 in that fact pattern. And so I'm wondering if you know, before that far, is required. But I think that particular question you know, doesn't need to be answered in order to answer the specific fact pattern. It does seem that in this simple fact pattern, we've lost control under IFRS 10, and there does seem to be a trend in IFRS, some sorts of things that might cloud that question. So, you know, I think the paragraph 103 reference is maybe something we might want to think about in the final wording of the tentative agenda decision. On the order point that someone raised as to whether or not, you know, I apply IFRS 10 and then IFRS 16, you know, I did pause on that myself when I was thinking about this as well, but I think similar to what Petrina was describing, it just struck me that the sort of natural ordering here has to be, you know, 10 first, 16. You know, I do need to decide whether I have a derecognition event for there to possibly ever be a say, a leaseback. So I, you know, although, you know, you can envision it, an ordering question there, it just struck me that is sort of the natural common sense way to think about this in this particular fact pattern was 10 first, then 16.
Okay, thank you, Guy. You're cutting up out a little bit, but I think we got your overall messages there. Jim?
I also feel the confusion and the concerns that other mentioned about this case. I think the way it's laid out is making us thinking too much of the fact pattern and the principles or standards applicable. For example, introducing the concept of IFRS 15, making us thinking that it's not a full sale of the entity, or is you sold the entity, but still somehow you remain the control of the only asset is underneath the entity. So it's not a fact pattern mentioned. So that's why we are all confused by introducing the three standards altogether, the 10, the 15th, and the 16th. Actually, I don't think we should really consider IFRS 15 in this fact pattern. On page 2, the fact pattern mentioned paragraph 6 clearly. The entity P sold the entity S and to a third party and lost control of the entity. That's it. We don't need to, or we should not consider. Somehow, entity P is still remaining control of the assets, the only asset valuable in the subsidiary. How come? Or if that might be the case, it's not, there's a fair value problem. So just, I don't think introducing IFRS 15 here is helping us understanding or recognizing the fact pattern mentioned. So if we are selling a fully owned subsidiary, this IFRS 10, and it's very clear that 100% to a third party, loss of control. If we think further, what if we still have somehow controlled part of the interest we sold? That's not the fact pattern. So this, I think first, that's the biggest concern that at least make me pause for a while. What's going on? Are we selling the entity together with the asset, or we somehow kept a part of it? Actually, even the fact pattern mentioned, we didn't. We sold them all. So I think if we mention, just in case, it also, if only if the building is not under a subsidiary. It's directly owned on our book. It's okay by 15th, but it just not a direct fact pattern mentioned. So I think here, mentioning IFRS 15 is not a appropriate way of analyzing the fact pattern. And secondly, I also have some concerns about the two-step approach. I think just Guy also mentioned some part of the two-step approach. If we apply these two standards, first and second, always the second wins, because the second will change or override the first. I don't think that's the way to apply standards. And I think a key part of the analysis is should be addressed or should be emphasized to solve the puzzle, which is on paragraph 29. On paragraph 29, it said, NTDP received cash and a lease as consideration for the transaction. I see this, the true nature of the fact pattern. In this way, we should really put IFRS 10 and 16 together simultaneously, not two steps to solve the puzzle. We are not selling the building by itself. It's the consideration is both a cash and a lease. So the consideration should not only be the 800, and also we should consider the IFRS 16 approaches as mentioned in the paper. So I think the conclusion or the decision is okay, I accept that. But the way to address this fact pattern and to introduce the three standards altogether is making a little bit confusion here.
Thanks, Jim. I do agree with your point that it is quite complicated when we start referring to the three standards, and I think it's important that we don't confuse people so that they think that we mean that you're in the scope of 15, but rather we're just referring to that analysis which is sort of derived from 15, if I could use those words. But I wonder, even though it sort of makes it look like more steps, if you like, to Bob's initial point, whether, even though in this fact pattern it's hard to imagine how you'd get to a different analysis with 15, because it's such a simple fact pattern that you're selling 100% of the shares and all you're doing is leasing back. So I agree with your point, Jim, that it feels like, you know, overkill in this situation. But I think the thing we always have to be a little bit conscious of with agenda decisions is people pick them up and then apply them in slightly different contexts as well. So having the formal reminder that you need to think about loss of control under 10, 16 tells you to do this analysis that uses 15, and then you get to the leaseback analysis, that there are sort of is three aspects, might just be useful for fact patterns which might be slightly more complicated than those that are in the simple fact pattern as well. But that's just a thought, even though I agree it sort of does add to the complexity of the analysis. I think that is, you know, a sort of faithful representation of the steps that you're asked to walk through. Marie?
Thank you. In the fact pattern, we do agree that the analysis and conclusion makes sense as it's, for instance, consistent with the sale and leaseback of an item of PPE. But we think that the standards are not clear enough to consider that IFRS 10, you apply IFRS 10 first and afterwards IFRS 16, meaning that sort of IFRS 16 overrides IFRS 10. I think, as it was mentioned by Carsten, it's sort of overlay, if we can say. So we consider it might be really challenging to enforce, and we are not sure it can be solved through an agenda decision. And another comment we have is that we had the impression that the fact patterns might be a lot more complex. For example, it will not be a 100% ownership. There is a question of business, the number of assets you have, and these kinds of things. So as people might use the conclusion on this one to other fact patterns, as you mentioned, we run the risk of, I think, having diversity and difficulty on the enforcement. And for this element, we think it might have been useful to do an outreach just to understand other stack patterns that people might have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure if we put the agenda decision out, we'll get lots of fact patterns. Michael, you're in the room and without the ability to put your Toblerone up, so do you want to come in now?
Thanks, Sue. So my observation, like everybody else, it seems clear to me that it's the right answer and that the substance of the transaction is a sale and leaseback transaction. I also paused about the two steps. I think as accountants, we're like, oh, this is a model. We need to apply it. How else does it apply? Are there unintended consequences? And I was slightly down that rabbit hole as well as some others. I think I would agree with what Karsten was saying, that I'm not sure it goes far as wanting to quote IS 8, but something about 10 not envisaging the consideration being in the form of a sale and leaseback, and there is more specific guidance, then that seems to ring-fence the conclusion more than a general model about the order in which you might apply standards, I thought.
OK, thank you. John?
Yeah, my comments were similar to those raised by Karthin and now just by Michael, that I agree with the overall conclusion. And as I was thinking back about the discussion in the discussion previously by the committee that's referenced in paragraph 37, I think that the sequencing of that, looking at that first makes sense, because in order to sell the subsidiary with the asset, one must first put the asset into the subsidiary. So I think that sequencing coming first made sense. But then after that, the actual sale and leaseback transaction with the deconsolidation of the subsidiary, if I just take a step back and I think about the substance of the transaction, to stop with only applying IFRS 10, to me, would not represent the nature of the transaction as executed, or as stated here in the paper. So I didn't think of IFRS 10 and then IFRS 16 as a sequencing of events, rather a bit as like Michael was saying, that it seems to be there's a more relevant piece of literature that we need to consider, because applying IFRS 10 on its own without considering IFRS 16 and the leaseback elements of that standard would misrepresent the nature of the transaction. And since there is more specific guidance that is directly on point, it'd be appropriate under IAS 8 to consider that guidance when representing the transaction. So that was my thoughts as I reviewed the fact pattern in the paper.
Okay, thanks, John. Donna.
Thank you. So I agree with the conclusion reached by the staff in the staff paper, and it's very fascinating to hear everyone's perspective. So, Jim, definitely, when I looked at the paper the first time, the very first thing that came to mind was substance over form. The reality is that who cared about the fact that the company only owned the asset, you know, step away, the substance is that all that you've done is you've entered in a sale and leaseback. And then obviously the first thing that Whitson, you need to kind of look at is that it's very difficult to kind of continue in an IFRIC situation, in my mind, to be able to say, listen, you apply substance over form, because it can be applied in many, many different ways. So what I then did is I took a step back and I said, well, is there anything else in IFRS that kind of allows us to apply a stepped approach? And funny enough, IFRS 9 actually talks specifically to a situation where the very first step in derecognition is to consider whether you consolidate or deconsolidate the subsidiary. So I am of the belief that there is sufficient principle within IFRS to support the assumption that the very first thing we do is we actually look at whether we've lost control over the subsidiary in terms of IFRS 10. And then the second thing we then look at is, well, what is the remaining rights and obligations that we've now obtained within a new contract? So even though the contracts may technically, well, this is the thing, normally these contracts, at least in the South African context, these contracts are not written they're not written together. You would have a separate sale agreement between the two shareholders, and then you would then have a subsequent agreement between the two parties to sell and lease or to lease back the asset. So by applying those types of principles, one, the principle in IFRS 9 that says that you always consider in your very first step of derecognition whether you consolidate or deconsolidate the subsidiary, I think tick, we definitely apply that approach. A And then the second process, which is a principle that seems to be quite prevalent in derecognition, is that you then need to look at the rights and obligations that have been retained by the party. Now, that would be evidenced by the contract that you've entered into. So I'm very supportive of the paper. I do have a couple of comments with respect to, if we're applying a two-step approach, I think the journal in 29, so Jen will actually refer to this, I think that may cause a little bit of confusion with the reader to kind of say, well, if you're applying a two-step approach, should you not actually just be dealing specifically with the sale of the sub to start with? And then the second comment was, is that if there's any, whether we should not be a little bit more explicit about the fact that the gain is all in the same line, that it's the same gain that we're actually trying to recognize. So if I put my transactor hat on, is there a chance that this could be construed as an opportunity to engineer a certain presentation in the income statement, for example, by having the gain that has been recognized with the loss that comes around when you adjust gain on the sale of the sub in a different line in the income statement? And those are my points. Thank you.
Thank you. Sophie.
Hello. So I also agree with the conclusion that full gain should not be recognized because of the substance of the operation, and it is fully relevant and consistent with the basis of conclusion of IFRS 16. I also see that the paper refers to similar cases where there is an overlay approach that applies. And I think that some of these exams are quite relevant, and I agree with the fact that there are some overlay approach that exist in the IFRS framework. But I also see that in the past, the board considered that there were some, and even the committee considered that there were some conflict between different standards. And in particular, if I refer to paragraph 34 of the paper and paragraph 25, you refer to the case of IFRS 16 or IFRS 40 and the link with IFRS 16. However, I think that in the paper, it should be highlighted that paragraph 68 and paragraph 69 of IS 16 and IS 40 highlight and specify at the end in two brackets a reference to IFRS 16. It is written unless IFRS 16 requires otherwise on a sale and leaseback. So in IS 16 and IS 40, there is a clear reference to IFRS 16 that does not exist, of course, in IFRS 10. So I see that in this case, the board decided to add something to IS 16 and IS 40. Why not? I wonder. My question is: why not the present case? Why should we have an overlay approach? Why is it so obvious? And also, Guy Jones referred to the conflict that was discussed and that for which there was an amendment in IFRS 10 and IFRS 28. Here, it was clear the board said that there was a conflict between the two standards. I don't see really what is the difference with the current situation.
Okay, thank you, Sophie. I've got a couple of people who want to come back in who have spoken before, so if it's okay with you, I'm going to let people who haven't spoken yet come in first, and then I'll circle back. I promise my intent is not to forget you. If I do, inadvertently, let me know. So using that approach, the next person I think on my list is Goro.
Thank you, Sue. As far as this particular fact pattern of this submission concern, I would agree with the staff analysis and recommendation, but like some others, I am a bit confused. Particularly this IFRS 10 and 16 versus 15 and 16. economic substance of the corporate LAPA transaction and the outright sale and of the same building and the lease back appears to be exactly the same to me. And the, so, however, once the corporate LAPA is involved, the accounting of the transaction becomes more complicated than the outright sale and lease back transaction, which IFRS 15 and IFRS 16 could be applied. Although the results, our final results, how much gains are recognized is the same, etc. But still, I am still confused because it appears to me that this accounting for the corporate LAPA transaction appears to me that intuitively against the principle of substance over form. Although that it, some people are saying that it, this could satisfy, but from the financial statement user's point of view, I think I still think that the this transaction are very similar. So this may be the beyond the committee's responsibility. I think that this some kind of education material may be needed to be published to investors, particularly that this, you know, the IFRS 16 and the sales and leaseback transactions have become increasing the issue of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Goro. Renata.
Thank you. I would say that the transaction itself is kind of confusing, but the solution is more straightforward once you look to the IFRS 10. Since you start saying that you are losing control of a subsidiary, you have to look to IFRS 10. When I go to IFRS 10 and see B97 that gives you guidance about multiple arrangements, it leads you to IFRS 16. And looking to IFRS 16, you have to evaluate if you have a sale. So you have to go back to IFRS 15. And after that, conclude with IFRS 16. So I know it's kind of confusing, but by the end of the day, you cannot ignore that you are selling a subsidiary, at least in the form. But what is going to be in the end of the day in the financials is the actual transaction that, in my opinion, is the sale is back. So I would agree with the decision. But I would go with B97, that is multiple arrangements.
Okay. Thank you, Renata.
Thank you.
I was going to make a couple of general observations, but perhaps I'll let Bob and Carsten in first, and then I'll make a comment after that. So, Bob?
Okay. Thanks, Sue. I want to come back and respond to some of the questions, comments on applying both 10 and 16 in a sequential manner. I think we have to remember that while we've gotten a very simple fact pattern, that in this tentative agenda decision, what we are doing is we're laying out a model that people will look to in more complex situations. And so we have to be sure that, you know, we are able to handle those. Now, I think 16 has to apply, and I look to in 16, in the basis for conclusions, BC 261, in which the board said, the ISB observed that in considering whether a transaction should be accounted for as a sale leaseback transaction, and any should consider not only those transactions structured in the form of a legal sale leaseback, but should also consider other forms of transaction for which the economic effect is the same. So I think, you know, despite that this is in the selling of subsidiary, it is economically the same. The board is telling us in BC 261, I got to apply IFRS 16 for sale leaseback. I think I also have to apply IFRS 10 because I can have more complex situations, which I've personally seen. The subsidiary could have a non-controlling interest in it. And so how do I handle that? Well, I go back to 10. By the way, I would encourage the staff to think about an example with NCI because I've done one. And I think what happens is you pick up some of the gain somebody could say is associated with the NCI. When I do that, I'm okay with that, but I'd encourage you to look at that. I could also, and I've seen situations where they've sold a subsidiary that holds multiple assets and they lease back one of them. And so what do I do in that situation? Well, I think I have to apply IFRS 10. And I think, and I also see a situation where they sell it to the sub to another sub. And I think, you know, that's also would be applicable to 10. And I think you really apply the sequence. You apply 10 first because of these other situations. And it's very similar to IFRS 9, where I think you apply 10 first and then you look to the other criteria in 9. So I think it makes logical sense.
Thanks, Bob. Carsten.
Yeah, thanks. So just one response to the comments that several folks have made around this two-step approach, so that you can only have a lease after a transfer of the asset has happened. Now, I understand that, but it appears to me that people seem to have in mind the requirements in paragraph 100 of IFRS 16, as these are applicable to this particular fact pattern. So maybe you cannot have a lease without a previous transfer of an asset, but I think you can certainly have a sale lease back transaction without a previous transfer of an asset, as described in paragraph 103 of IFRS 16. So to me, this is not about whether you can have a lease after the transfer, but whether there can be a sale lease back transaction without a transfer. And I think, yes, you can, as described in paragraph 103.
Brian?
So, again, I just wanted to, similar to Bob, make a few observations on the discussion. I wasn't anticipating so many references to scope in the discussion, and I wonder if perhaps it would be helpful just to have some fairly blunt statements in the agenda decision about which standards do and don't apply. I also wasn't expecting so many observations about the two-step kind of approach. Interestingly, when I go back through the agenda paper, I can see that the references to the two-step approach are all in the step analysis to be there as kind of explanation of kind of what to do. They're not actually in the agenda decision itself, are they? Because in this very straightforward fact pattern, the application of the two standards, to me at least, seems absolutely kind of complementary. So I agree that some of these concerns about steps and sequencing, if we, in practice, after this discussion, go back to our offices and deal with other transactions, could be kind of quite important. But they're not actually a feature of the agenda decision itself. No. The agenda decision just describes the complementary application of both standards to this very specific and fairly narrow fact pattern.
So you let Brian in, he stole my thunder.
Oh, sorry.
Not a bad outcome because I shouldn't do all the talking, so that's okay. So what I was going to just observe based on having listened to all of your comments and your sort of thoughtful interactions is that I think just about everybody, from what I can remember, agreed with where we landed based on the requirements and the standards. So I think pretty much everybody agreed that in the end it was appropriate and it was a sort of correct application of the requirements to end up saying, okay, this should be analysed as a sale and leaseback transaction overall. You should be thinking about 10 and you should be thinking about 16 with the sort of reference to 15, and that's where you should land. Now, I think some people have got slightly different ways of how they get there in terms of how they fit it all together. I think the staff approached it the way that I would, which is in a very structured way, because we want the staff and we wanted to be comfortable that we were sort of abiding with the requirements as strictly set out in the standard, and they concluded that, and they got there a particular way. Other people have got there in different ways, but we sort of end up in the same place. I think Sophie certainly suggested that perhaps we should just, you know, sort of cut to the chase and make an amendment that makes it very specific, the same way as in IAS 16. But I think others were sort of more making what sounded to me like support for something in an agenda decision. And I wonder whether, after we vote on that, when we get to the agenda decision, whether we should keep in mind that exactly what Brian just pointed out, we don't actually say in the agenda decision you have to do this sort of step-by-step approach. Rather, the observation is you have to apply 10, you need to apply 16, and overall this is the analysis that you get to, which is sort of allowing people to get there in slightly different ways. So maybe just park that for the moment. And that just struck me as thinking back on the conversation. Now I'm going to see if we can, well, conscious of time. Let's vote at least on question two, which is whether the committee agrees with the staff's recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan. So then we'd be moving on to look at the wording of an agenda decision. You think not to do standard setting? Okay, Brian, and can...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 on screen, plus Brian, 12.
12, okay. All right. And then do you think we need to have a break before we go through the wording of the agenda decision?
Probably.
Yeah. We probably need to break, I think, because I'm not going to... It's not fair and nor appropriate to try and squeeze the discussion of the wording of the agenda decision into 5 minutes. So we'll stop now for a 15-minute break. And so we'll reconvene at 20 past one London time, so in 15 minutes' time. Thank you.